Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I got some.
Here's John Williams.
I'm going to do it here till 3, and then Saturday mornings from 10 to noon on WGN Radio. Domati Pongo will be doing the news then as well, I think. You're going to be doing the news tomorrow too, Domati?
Tomorrow, yes, I am.
It'd be really sad if you didn't. I missed you last week. You were on the road with that Mr. Fix-It show, so.
And IU.
I didn't get a chance to really play with you as much as I normally do.
Really missed you. Well, we did get a chance to chat this week about the floods.
You called in a report from that grade school in Lake County. Where were you exactly? Was it Elm something school?
W.J. Murphy I was at in Round Lake. Yeah.
In Round Lake. Oh.
They took in like $2 million worth of damage. It was crazy.
And that one school alone, insurance is going to pay for it, and they're on chart to open up the first day of school, which is really amazing. As you were saying that, I thought, this is a miracle. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I'll bet a lot of kids are going, darn.
I was thinking the exact same thing, because all you think about is tragedy. But as I talked to some residents there, some of those kids were kind of playing in the water, which is disgusting now that I think about it. But, you know, it's just funny how when these things happen, kids just react a little differently than we do.
Well, they're not paying the bills. They're still kids, which is lovely thing for them. Go be a kid.
I'm envious.
109, that's Domati Pongo in the WGN Radio Newsroom. He'll swap that seat with Steve Bertrand shortly. Domati and I, along with Sam Panionovich, will be visiting with you Saturday morning from 10 to noon. Griffin Filipich produces that show. We have a fun little team there. Sam pointed out to me in the office today that there was a brawl after a Little League game in Canaryville off of Halstead and maybe 40th or so. They had some sort of Little League game earlier in the week. I think this was Monday, but the video has just surfaced today. And you watch the video, it's hard to tell exactly what's going on or how many people were involved, but the reporting on it is that 50 adults were involved in a brawl after or during a Little League game. It doesn't happen on the field. It happens next to the field between the parking lot and the backstop of one of the dugouts of one of the fields. But it's one of these moving mosh pits of people, and every now and then you'll see a punch getting thrown and people getting shoved and people running around. The video goes a half hour, but people are talking about the first few minutes of it. We'll tell you that story and ask you what you've seen out there on our show tomorrow. By the way, our Ryan Burrow was at the president's speech in West Virginia today. You may have heard his reporting on ABC and here on WGN. I think he's at the airport right now. Hi, Ryan. It's John. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. You're the beneficiary of delayed flights, my friend, because I should be headed back to Chicago right now, but not the case. Keep getting pushed back.
Wow. Is it weather out there?
Or? To me, so what, there you go.
I'm happy for that. What's the deal?
You know, I don't know. It said that we got moved around different gates because of they're shuffling a bunch of stuff around. I think bad weather in other regions are making connecting flights mess up, and as a result, here we are. So
how many of the president
another hour? Or so
how many of President Trump's rallies or events have you been to?
Including before he was president, because remember he did that tour after he won. And he wasn't quite president yet, but I've been to, what, 3 in the last month, I want to say.
Oh, if you just threw them all together, from candidate through last night, how many events of his have you been to?
At least 10.
And how did last night's compare or contrast with what you've seen in the past?
It was a little different. There were a couple kind of different factors going. In the previous ones I've been to, they've been in states like Ohio and Iowa and Wisconsin, all states that he, won by pretty thin margin. This one was in West Virginia, and this is a red state. I think he won by something like 42 points, 44 points over Hillary Clinton in this state. So, the people came to support, and they were dancing in the aisles, and they were singing, and they were dancing with their signs. I hadn't seen anything like that at any of the other rallies. He was really actually very, very focused, very much on script. Didn't really try to walk the stage around and you know, start trying to tell jokes or, you know, point out the media and make fun of the media. No, he pretty much stayed on topic. He talked about Russia. He talked about coal jobs. He talked about the economy. He talked about immigration. Just kind of checked off the list and was pretty feisty in some of his remarks, too. So I don't know if that was just, you know, him trying to get some stuff off his chest following yesterday's news about the federal grand jury, or, you know, him just trying to leave a lasting impression before he goes on this break, or maybe it's the John Kelly effect.
He does have a 17-day vacation coming up, which is fine. You know, it's easy to be critical of presidents who take vacations. I think we should all stay away from that. And if you love Donald Trump, let the man have a vacation. If you don't love Donald Trump, let the man have a vacation. But I want to play
a working vacation.
Yeah, and that's the point.
Getting briefed.
Absolutely. Yeah. There is no vacation. Nancy Reagan famously said there is no vacation, just a change of scenery. But I want to play a soundbite for you, because while you said he seemed focused and was talking about Russia and some of the specific points he wanted to get out, one of the bites that's getting as much play anywhere is this.
The Russia story is a total fabrication. It's just an excuse for the greatest loss in the history of American politics. That's all it is.
So the president is still looking back and still touting his election win. I understand that he was handing out those red-colored electoral maps as well. Was that maybe the purpose of this, though, to just try and deflect from the Russian investigation? Did it feel like that, Ryan?
Well, no. I mean, I think he came out with some pretty strong statements. He's trying to take this thing head on, which is actually something he hasn't been doing in these rallies. He's been actually shying away from it and talking to people beforehand. They want him to. They don't really want to get muddled up. They think it's fake news. They think it's a distraction. And he did take it on last night. He had that quote. He had the one, and I apologize if Elif already has these queued up, but, you know, he asked the people, do you see Russians in West Virginia or Pennsylvania or Michigan or Ohio, you know, all the states that he won? He said, we didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you, pointing to the crowd.
It's so, a great line, yeah.
You know, he's saying, look, you guys are chasing, you know, chasing this, and this is getting a lot of play, but there's no there. And, you know, I don't know if that was frustration boiling over the news yesterday about the federal grand jury, or, you know, if this has just been something that's been simmering. But it was pretty new for these rallies for him to come out and say it. Not on the Twitter. He always talks about it on Twitter.
Yeah, but I think that line at that rally, it's no coincidence that he's saying that the day that Mueller says that we'll impanel a grand jury to look further into this with investigative and subpoena powers. So it's probably not a coincidence, but maybe it is a little bit, because he didn't know when Mueller was going to announce that. The president can obviously line his comments up, but the rally was preset. He can't anticipate Mueller, but he took advantage of the announcement to at least push back. My question for you, though, is this. What is the stated purpose of these rallies?
Well, if you ask him, it's to go out and talk to the people, right? This is his chance to speak directly to the people. He does it on Twitter, but he feels like a lot of his news filters through the media and it doesn't come out the way he wants. So this is his chance to directly talk to the people. Now, if you talk to the people, they say it works both ways, because he energizes them and they believe they energize him in return. I mean, every president does this. They want to get out of the White House. They want to push their agenda. Obama went out. You know, he would go to Chicago. He'd go to California. He'd push his message. George W. Bush would go, and when he was trying to reform Social Security, he would go out, you know, try to get out of Washington, D.C., because, unfortunately, that can be very oppressive. You know, the air there is, it's not just the air that's oppressive. It's, you know, all the politics that surround it. So, you know, just kind of breaking free and being able to, you know, hang out with your supporters, thousands of them last night.
Well, maybe that makes sense. I don't remember Barack Obama or George or any of the Bushes, even Bill Clinton, who might have been good at this. I don't remember them doing rallies, campaign-styled rallies, only months after they won the election. It strikes me as, and by the way, these aren't just, you know, pushing the planks of a certain policy. These are an opportunity to boo and jeer Hillary Clinton. These are different animals, I think, than what we've seen from other presidents, at least that I remember, Ryan.
Well, he is a show host. Keep that in mind. That's the background, right? The reality TV show host. And, you know, he gets to set this up and frame it up and, you know, sometimes it works, and sometimes we're talking about it the next day.
No kidding. All right, well, so one other thing about that, Ryan, then I'll let you go. How many people were there? It sounded gigantic. It's hard to know.
It was, I think they said the place can hold about 7,000. One section of the bleachers was cut because of the media, and then there were people on the floor. So it was probably pretty close to that. But, yeah, it was loud. It's an arena football stadium or a civic center where they have arena football. So, you know, it's also kind of a positioning of the speakers and where the people are. But you got to remember, too, yesterday was also about the governor, the Democratic governor flipping parties. He came out and announced that he was no longer going to be Democrat. He just lines up too closely with Donald Trump and flipped to a Republican this morning, or will this afternoon, I guess.
By the way, here's that line that you were also referring to at the rally last night.
Most people know there were no Russians in our campaign. There never were. We didn't win because of Russia. We won because of you. That I can tell you.
That's a great line. That's a great delivery of that line. I think you, don't go there, John. Don't prosecute the last election all over again. Just let him have that moment. All right, Ryan, listen, safe travels to you. We'll see you when you get back in the building, okay?
All right, sounds good. Warm it up for me. Sounds like it's chilly there.
Oh, my God, it's crazy. Steve Bertrand, what's the current temperature in Chicago right now?
23.
It feels like it. Feels like football, which is kind of nice, but it feels like October and that we should be talking about the Bears being 0-3 right now or whatever it's going to be.
By the way, took a 2.5-hour trip through the rolling hills of northern Kentucky to get here to Cincinnati. Gorgeous drive. I recommend it for anyone.
Yeah, that is a pretty part of the country. I can't say I've taken that trip, but I've been to Virginia and the western part of Virginia and some of that part of the woods, and it just could not be more lovely, that's for sure.
If you've got time, bring us home some Skyline Chili, Ryan.
Skyline Chili, Ryan.
I was going to bring you some bourbon, but all right, I'll go with the chili.
Thanks, Steve. He's bringing out a can of beans, and we could have had some bourbon. All right, stay well. Drive safely, fly safely, whatever you're doing to get back. That's our Ryan Burrow, who is covering the president last night for ABC. It's interesting, though, because the president's conversations, and we talked about this about 15 minutes ago when Steve and I were just visiting briefly on the air. So we also have the transcripts. There's two interesting things that we now have today that we didn't have yesterday or had yesterday that we didn't have before. One is the actual audio of Scaramucci visiting with the New Yorker reporter. We've read what he said, and it's alarming and led to his firing. But now we can actually hear the conversation, too. And that's fascinating in a whole nother way. But I'm, once again, not entirely sure what the value is of releasing the audio now, too, except that it perpetuates the opportunity. It's just another way to dig at Trump and the band of loonies that he has working around him. I think it's valuable to shine a light on these things. I don't know when, though, we begin to pile on. And the releasing of this audio so that we can have another few days of Scaramucci head-scratching is, to me, not all that necessary. But then you also have the transcripts of the phone conversations he had with the leaders of Australia and Mexico. And in those cases, you see the president posturing and sort of negotiating and then finding out what the big dig is on that. I mean, really, 10-page transcript of his phone call with the president of Mexico. And everybody's talking about how Trump said that we have to be careful how we position the payment for the wall because that will look bad for me politically. I have to be able to say you guys are going to pay for it, even as a deal was trying to be constructed between their two teams to make that happen. You know, not Mexico write a check. How are we going to do that? But there's Trump saying, but I've campaigned for 2 years on Mexico will pay for it. I've got to be able to say that. And so they go back and forth, and actually eventually reach a point of conciliation. I'm not sure that there's a lot of value in us having access to that. And this is a talk show host. I mean, this is my lifeblood. But I'm not sure that that is in our best interest. Obviously, it's not in Donald Trump's best interest. Actually, I think Trump's the only one that comes out ahead on this. Because if you read the transcripts, you find Trump talking to, and not that Mexico is something to be feared, but Lord, they're important to us. And you don't want to screw that up. But the United States doesn't need to cower. You know who the big dog in the room is when the president of Mexico is on with the president of the United States. And then there he is talking to the Australian prime minister as well, Malcolm Turnbull. And so it's just kind of interesting to hear the tone that Trump takes, the way he actually deals with these people. And he is a bull in a china shop. I think a lot of people will read that and go, that is exactly why we voted for you. Because he is speaking truth to somebody else's power. He is saying exactly how he feels, even as you see him sort of burning bridges that they're helping him build. Even as particularly in Turnbull's case, he's going, well, now, Mr. President, it's not that. It's this. All you've got to do is say this. You guys made a deal. What is the word of the president if he doesn't honor commitments his country makes? He's trying to help him there, and Trump will have none of it. He goes, nope, this makes me look bad. I don't want to do it. We're not doing it. Boom. That's his tone. And I think if you read that and you are a Trump supporter marginally or especially, you will appreciate how he handled that. Not everybody feels that way, however. You sit there in your heartache, waiting on some beautiful boy to save you from your Killers are playing tonight. Lots of Lala lovers downtown. I guess you won't need your umbrellas, but you're going to need your coats. .127 on WGN Radio. This is John Williams. I don't know where to begin. You know, I thought the Mexico, conversation he had with the president of Mexico was maybe going to be the most interesting. But you go to the conversation he had with the Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, and it's you can feel the exasperation on Turnbull's side. It begins this way. Turnbull says, and I'm always intrigued by the little things. Like, here's literally how the conversation begins. Turnbull, good evening. Our president says, Prime Minister, how are you? I'm doing very well. And I guess our friend Greg Norman, he's doing very well. Turnbull says, he's a great mutual friend. Yes. Trump says, well, you say hello to him. He's a good friend. By the way, thank you very much for taking the call. I really appreciate that. It is really nice. That's Donald Trump. Turnbull says, thank you very much. Everything's going well. And then everything went bad. Because we had this deal with Australia that Barack Obama said, and it was the opportunity for the United States to vet up to 2,000, it was actually 1,250, economic refugees, prisoners that were being kept in Australia. And that was Obama's deal. And the first call that the president of the United States has with the Australian prime minister is about this thing, and he hates it. Donald Trump does not want to honor this commitment. And the prime minister says about the agreement, this is Turnbull, well, the vice president, that's Pence, just called the foreign minister about less than 24 hours ago and said your administration would be continuing. Does not require you to take 2,000 people. It does not require you to take any. Turnbull says it requires, in turn, for us to do a number of things for the United States. This is a big deal. I think we should respect deals. Trump said, who made the deal? Obama? Turnbull says, yes, but let me describe what it is. I think it's quite consistent. I think that you can comply with it. It is absolutely consistent with your executive order, so please hear me out. You can decide to take them or not take them after vetting. You can decide to take 1,000, 100. It's entirely up to you. The obligation is to only go through the process. So that is the first thing. Secondly, the people, none of these people are from the conflict zone. They are basically economic refugees from Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Trump said, why haven't you let them out? Why have you not let them into your society? Turnbull says, okay, I will explain why. It is not because they are bad people. It is because in order to stop people smugglers, we have had to deprive them of the product. So we have said, if you try to come to Australia by boat, even if we think you're the best person in the world, even if you are a Nobel Prize winning genius, we will not let you in because the problem with the people, Trump says, that's a good idea. We should do that too. You're worse than I am. I believe that's Trump going, oh, that's so sinister. That's so clever. You sneaky guy. Well, I don't know what he's saying, but he says, you're worse than I am. And I believe that's a compliment. Turnbull says, this is our experience. Trump says, because you do not want to destroy your country. Germany is a mess because of what happened. And Turnbull says, I agree with you. Letting 1 million Syrians walk into their country, it was one of the big factors, the Brexit vote, frankly. That's Turnbull. Trump says, Malcolm, why is this so important? I do not understand. This is going to kill me. I'm the world's greatest person that does not want to let people into the country, and now I'm agreeing to take 2,000 people, and I can agree that I can vet them, but that puts me in a bad position. It makes me look so bad, and I've only been here a week. Turnbull, with great respect, that is not right. It's not 2,000. Well, it's close. I've also heard like 5,000. The given number is 1,250, and it's entirely a matter of your vetting. I think that what you could say is that the Australian government is consistent with the principles set out in the executive order. No, says Trump, I do not want to say that. I will just have to say that, unfortunately, I will have to live with what they said, what was said by Obama. I will say I hate it. Look, I spoke to Putin, Merkel, Abe of Japan, France today, and this is my most unpleasant call because I'll be honest with you. I hate taking these people. I guarantee you they are bad. That is why they're in prison right now. They're not going to be wonderful people who go on to work for the local milk people. By the way, local milk people is trending today on Twitter. Turnbull says, I would not be so sure about that. They are basically, Trump cuts them off. Well, maybe you should let them out of prison. I'm doing this because Obama made a bad deal. I am not going to do this because it fits into my executive order. Turnbull says, but I can say to you, there is nothing more important in business or politics than a deal is a deal. Look, you and I have a lot of mutual friends. And Trump says, look, I do not know how you got them to sign a deal like this, but that is how they lost the election. They said, I had no way to 270. I got 306. He's now bragging about his 306 electoral votes in his first phone call to the guy in Australia, to Turnbull. He says that is why they lost the election, because of stupid deals like this. You've brokered many a stupid deal in business, and I respect you, but I guarantee that you broke many a stupid deal. This is a stupid deal. This deal will make me look terrible. And Turnbull says, Mr. President, I think this will make you look like a man who stands by the commitments of the United States. Okay. This shows me to be a dope. That's what this is. I have to do it. I will do it, but I don't like this at all. Not even a little bit. You have to see what I'm doing. I am not going to say that this fits within the realm of my executive order. We're going to allow 2,000 prisoners to come to our country, and it's within the realm of my executive order. If that is the case, my executive order does not mean anything, Malcolm. I look like a dope. The only way that I can do this is to say that my predecessor made a deal, and I have no option but to honor the deal. I hate having to do it, but I'm going to vet them very closely. Suppose I vet them closely, and I don't take any. And Turnbull says, that's the point I've been trying to make. Trump says, how does that help you? Turnbull says, well, we assume that we will act in good faith. Trump says, does anybody know these people? Who are they? Are they going to become the next Boston bomber in 5 years or two? Who are these people? He asked Turnbull for a guarantee that they won't do something terrible. Turnbull says, I can't promise you that. It's 1:34. So that's in the public domain now. You and I get to hear that. It's fascinating, isn't it? I'm not sure it's in anybody's best interest that we do, though. At the end of that conversation with Turnbull, Turnbull goes, so do you want to talk about Syria and North Korea? Trump says, this is crazy. It's important to you, and it's embarrassing to me. It's an embarrassment to me. At least I got you off the hook, so you can put me back on the hook. Turnbull says, you can count on me, sir. He says, I hope so. Okay, thank you, Malcolm. Okay, thank you. And they hang up. So people who don't like the president will go, see, the guy's out of control. He's an egomaniac. And the people that do like President Trump, I think, hear that transcript and go, that's what I'm voting for. That's what I wanted. I think there's a zero-sum game here. I'm not sure if that's the correct use of zero-sum game.
One more thing.
Yeah.
You've been following the Martin Shkreli case?
Sure have.
He has been found guilty on 3 of the 8 counts, not guilty on 5 counts.
3 of the 5?
3 of the 8.
3 of the 8. So yeah. How long is he going to go to jail?
You know, John, I don't know. We just got that number. I don't know what three they are. But
he could have done 20 years. Wow. Okay. I wonder if he's going to stop tweeting and posting snarky things on Facebook now.
Well, I think he's probably pretty encouraged now.
Say it again.
Well, not guilty on five of the eight.
Boy, to me, this is the glass is half empty. You think it's half full.
It could have been eight. Let me change that. I'm the empty guy. Let me be the empty guy.
If I've just been found guilty on three of eight counts, the operative number to me is three. I've been found guilty on three counts, and I'm going to go to jail now. I do not see that as a win.
I see it if it's three, and I don't know anything yet about what these counts are. But if you're found guilty on three and not the other five, you're probably found guilty on three lesser ones.
Probably so.
Walk.
Oh, you think so?
I shouldn't even be saying that because I don't even know what he was convicted on. But
yeah, we don't know what the specific charges were, the eight of them. And none of them were for being a terrible person and charging people way too much for drugs. It was more because of the Ponzi scheme that he set up. And while they said that the people in the scheme, that is the victims, all profited, the prosecution said that doesn't change the fact that you can't do that. Just because you're good at a crime, it's sort of like if you, I don't know what the bank robbery analogy is. There's one there. But just because you're good at it and everybody won doesn't mean that it's okay to do it. Okay, three of the eight. Shrelly is...
I'm trying to find here for the...
By the way, we've been listening to fine music there from Foster the People. The name of that song was Houdini, one of the bands playing at Lollapalooza tonight as temperatures plummet into the teens. Just kidding about the teens, but it's funny because everybody that's got their Lollapalooza gear on walking up and down Michigan Avenue are wearing shorts and T-shirts and jerseys and cool clothes, or, you know, warm clothes, clothes that expose a lot because that's the way you like to go to summer concerts. But it's cold. The parents are all got jackets on. I saw a guy with a knit cap a little while ago. It's 1:45. I've been reading from the transcripts of the conversations that the president had with the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, and also the President of Mexico. And they're just remarkable for a number of reasons. What people are talking most about is the conversation he had with Nieto, and that was where he was saying that the way we position the payment for the wall is critical to me politically. And by the way, where Turnbull was saying to, it's very interesting, Turnbull in Australia seems to be much more confident and sure of himself. He doesn't defer that much. He says, no, Mr. President, here's how you play this. Here's what's happening. He's very direct. He's kind of on his level. Whereas the president of Mexico is so deferential. I so appreciate your taking your call. And we want nothing but the best for both of our countries. You are a great man, Mr. President. We support everything that you're trying to do to keep crime out of both of our countries. It's like that. He almost sounds as desperate. And then Trump gets to the part where he says, look, if we can't work out a deal, this is to Mexico now, I want to tell you, we are going to put a very substantial tax on the border coming into the United States. Honestly, we will not want your products unless your products are also going to be taxed. I do not want to do that if we can't work out a deal. So Jared Kushner and Luis, that's their foreign minister, have teams that are working out a deal. The only thing I will ask you, though, is on the wall. This is Trump. You and I both have a political problem. My people stand up and say, Mexico will pay for the wall. But the fact is, we are both in a little bit of a political bind because I have to have Mexico pay for the wall. I have to. I have been talking about it for the past 2-year period. And the reason I say they're going to pay for the wall is because Mexico's made a fortune out of the stupidity of the U.S. trade representatives. They're beating us at trade, and they're beating us at the border, and they're killing us with drugs. Now, I know you're not involved with that, but regardless of who is making all the money, billions and billions and billions, some people say more, is being trafficked, is being made on drug trafficking that is coming through Mexico. So what I would like to recommend is, if we're going to have continued dialogue, we will work out the wall. They are going to say, who is going to pay for the wall, Mr. President, to both of us? And we should both say, we will work it out. It will work out in the formula somehow, as opposed to you saying, we will not pay, and me saying, we will not pay. Fair enough. In fact, they actually sort of come to an agreement along those lines. A couple real quick phone calls, then a movie review for you. Hey, Matt, this is John. You're on WGN. What can I do for you?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. First off, JGC alum, go Wolves.
Go Wolves.
But I just kind of want to focus in on the Turnbull thing. Way back when, during the White House Correspondents' Dinner, when Obama was president, and he just was just roasting Trump unbelievably, and Trump was the only one not laughing. you know, if we didn't already think he had thin skin, that pretty much proved it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe Steve can look into this. But there was a Frontline piece where they talked to a couple Trump insiders where Trump himself made that decision at that dinner, saying, I'm going to take the keys from the White House from this guy and basically undo everything that he has done, basically saying, well, he's going to poke fun at me. Fine, I'm going to undo his legacy. And this Turnbull conversation seems to me just adding evidence to that theory that he's not doing it for whether it's good or bad or for policy. He's just doing it just because Obama did it. Well, I'm going to undo it. Obama didn't do it. Well, I'm going to do this. Look at the jamboree.
That's an interesting point. Oh, yeah.
You know, Obama didn't come to the jamboree. Well, I'm here. You know, and it's like one of those things, like it plays right into the not every Trump voter, but many of his supporters just fundamentally hated Obama to the core, not on policy, just because they just hated whether
that's
it was
so interesting. Because and Turnbull is saying, no, you don't have to take 2,000. It's 1,250. You only have to vet them. Our government's made this deal. And he said, yeah, but I can't do anything that Obama did. So then you, even as they're talking, Trump keeps spinning it into something more nefarious than it is. These are economic refugees. And the only reason they're in jail is because they cannot accept them. Otherwise, everybody's going to come. So even people that don't deserve to be jailed in Australia have been jailed. And they're asking the United States to vet them. And the United States has made this agreement. And Trump won't do it because it's Obama's baby.
Exactly. You know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's just that it continues to just pile up of every new thing that he undoes, something is undone. Why? Because Obama did it and put it in place. Well, good, I'm just going to undo it. And it just, if it was maybe only a couple things, I wouldn't be thinking that. But because it just seems to be each and everything, even when there's bipartisans, you know, with the Paris Climate Agreement, there were some on both sides, I believe, that said, this might be sort of a bad idea. But again, he's doing it just because of everything is Obamacare is bad. He did this that was bad. Bad deal.
And I think some people would say that, and some people are happy with that. I mean, a lot of people are. That's why they voted for him. Listen, fellow Wolverine, I got to go. Matt, thanks for the phone call. It's 1:50. I don't know what you're doing this weekend. Changing subjects now. You're going to go to a movie? Are you going to go see that Dunkirk finally? Boy, it's been making money. And some people absolutely love it, and some people don't. I'm in the didn't absolutely love it group. My producer, Griffin, who works with us on Saturdays, did see the movie. Griff sees all of the movies. I respect few voices on film more than Griffin's. So, Griffin's review is next.
Where are we going? Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Some of the only lines in the movie Dunkirk that you can actually understand. But that's just me. Producer Griffin saw the movie yesterday. Hi, Griff.
Hi.
Was it yesterday you saw it?
Last night, yeah, at the Music Box in Chicago at 9:30 p.m.
70mm with the great big sound system. 1 to 23 jujubes. What do you give it?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about the jujube
1
meter.
To 23 jujubes. What do you give it?
Oh, I'd go 18.
So you
I don't
didn't
know what that means,
you didn't yeah. either. You didn't love love
number.
You did not love it either, did you?
I liked it a lot. No, I didn't love it like some people, but okay. I really liked it.
All right, tell me what you liked about the movie, then tell me what you didn't like about Dunkirk.
Well, I'm also seeing this movie in response, and in my head, I can't get you out of it the whole time because I know you're very vocal about why you didn't like it.
Okay.
And so your voice was nagging at me the whole time, and I immediately saw how you loved Christopher Nolan's last movie, Interstellar, and yet didn't much love this one because each of Nolan's movies is a puzzle. There's some, like, central gimmick, do you know what I mean? And in this one, there's the altered the three different timelines. You're on land, and that one lasts a week. You also see the Dunkirk from the sea, and that lasts one day. And then there's the aviation to the sky, which lasts 1 hour. And it's playing with these three different timelines, you know?
I didn't realize. I mean, I knew it was land, sea, and air, but I was confused.
Did you
because
see the movie?
Well,
did you see it?
I saw the movie, and some of the scenes were at night, and then they'd cut to a guy during the day, and I go, well, what's up with that?
It's a puzzle. He's obsessed with this thing. He made a movie called The Prestige, which functions like a magic trick. He's very gimmicky, which is maybe a...
Would have been nice if they told us that, if he'd just come out before the film and go, okay, just so you know, I'm into puzzles.
It absolutely does, but we don't have any time to talk about that. It says in the beginning, it says 1 hour, land. Or one week, one day, but
it says that on the screen.
It 100% says.
Okay,
that
I'm sure it did, and I'm
beginning.
Sure I saw that, and I happen to be fluent in English, but it would have been nice if they had just dwelled on the sort of MO of this film a little more. But never mind that. Tell us what you liked about the movie.
Well, I like the puzzle of it. Usually his puzzles can be a little convoluted for convolution's sake or superfluous to actual meaning of the movie. But here, I actually thought it was useful. You see different perspectives in this one grand event, and it shows you that this one horrible thing that happened to hundreds of thousands of people was not the same to any one of them, that they all experienced it differently. And I found that very powerful near the end of this movie. There's this complicated sense of what actually happened, even though like love of country does overwhelm them briefly, or a complicated sense of defeat at the end, even though they survived, they, you know, were defeated.
Yeah, they were a little conflicted at the end, some of them.
Churchill calls it like a horrible, I can't remember his exact wording, but it was not a win by any means, but they did survive. That's what the movie is about, I think, is survival. It's like experiential. So you don't learn about like the nuances of warfare or naval strategy that were going on in this at all. You don't even learn about the characters at all.
Nope.
They're only built through performances. You don't know anything about their backstory.
Nope.
It's purely experiential. You have to buy into that. And if you don't, I could understand why you wouldn't like it. But
if they would have told me, if when they were throwing up hour, day, week, if they would have gone, by the way, this is experiential, we're not going to really help you with this. You just have to let it. Then I would have gone, oh, okay, it's going to be like that. I got 90 seconds.
You can feel that at like 10 minutes in, though? Like, okay, this is probably what I'm in for.
A friend of mine here at work, I kept going, at some point he's going to just break her down for me, but he didn't. A friend of mine at work made that leap about halfway through. You made it sooner.
Yeah.
I'm happy for all of you. I got a minute left. Tell me things that you didn't like about the movie.
I think there are limits to the kind of story that you can tell with that kind of filmmaking. It reminded me of Gravity a little bit, too, which is just all constant screw tightening. It's not even tension and release. It's just tension and tension, it's just the constant struggle to survive. You get through one obstacle and there's immediately another one. And I think there is a limit to the kind of story you can tell with that. And like,
you were tense in this movie. You were like, oh my God, what's going to happen next?
Absolutely. Oh,
you
my
knew,
gosh, yeah.
You knew how it's going to end. I mean, this is history. It's Dunkirk.
Have you ever seen a movie based on a real event, though? You know how they're all going to end.
All right, but I'm like, well, I know they're all going to survive, and I just think he missed such huge opportunities.
You don't know that they're all going to survive. I mean, they're being bombed. You don't know who. I mean, I don't know.
But there was so little interest in the individual characters that if one of them had died. We don't need to talk in any great detail here, but I mean, I'm not vested in any of them. But don't you think they missed an opportunity to show the grand sweep of this thing?
I liked that they didn't tend towards that. That's what I think the strength of the movie is, that it takes you to the ground level, into personal experiences. That's what they chose to do. But I will say, it's true that you don't know anything about any of these characters, and I do think that is not a fatal flaw. I think the movie works pretty well. But, it did rub up against me sometimes where I felt like, oh, I wish I cared more about this guy.
All right, time's up, Griffin. Yeah, okay. The interview's over. I don't know what's more frustrating to me, going to the movie or hearing your review of this movie now, because you liked it, you experienced it on a level that I couldn't. Maybe I should go back and give it one more try. You know what I mean?
I think it's fine that you didn't like it. That's okay. I just did.
I feel like I failed the film because I didn't appreciate it. That's my problem.
Expectations are everything. It's been a big summer for overrating movies. It happened with Baby Driver 2. It happened with a lot of good movies that are good but not great.
I'll talk to you another day. Thank you, Griffin.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Here we go. It's 208. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Really glad you're listening.
Lord have mercy.
And thanks to producer Griffin, our Saturday producer and sometimes voice. He's not with us this Saturday, so thanks for the review on Dunkirk. A couple of texts about that. From 312 area code, John, Dunkirk, possibly the loudest, most obnoxious soundtrack ever. I left with a headache. That's from Dave in Tucson. This from the 847 area code says, John, I'm with you. I would have loved it if I could have understood the dialogue above all the loudness and get off my lawn. Yeah, I'm a little bit that way about this movie, and I shouldn't be. I feel bad for Griffin because, as he said, I so had you in my head as I'm watching this movie. Don't you hate it when somebody said something particular, either very good or very bad about a movie, a concert, a CD, whatever, a song, and now you're sort of running that experience through their filter? It's not your own experience. And I apologize, Griff, if I did that to you or if I'm doing that to you. Go see the movie. You can tell us what you think. We were talking about the immigration policy that the president and some of the Republican senators are putting forward, Senator Cotton, et cetera. And we reached out yesterday to somebody who was with Numbers USA. And the idea was, at least in their case, that this is a very good proposal. This RAISE Act that's going to limit the number of people coming into this country is good for everybody. There may be a different view on that. Alex, oh, shoot, now I want to make sure I get the last name right. Naresta, Alex Naresta joins us, immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute. Alex, it's John Williams. Thanks for taking our call. You're on WGN.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. And great job on the pronunciation.
You got to change either the spelling or the pronunciation of that thing, man.
Well, you know, preferably both. Something like Jones, I think, would be better.
Well, I got news for you. Williams isn't my real last name. My real last name looks a little like Naresta, and they said, you got to change that, so I did. But I didn't want to. You know, actually, I think we should embrace the different ethnicities and pronunciations. You know, you've got me off on a tangent here to start the interview. I really shouldn't. But when I hear a complicated name on the radio, like my friend Domiti Pongo, or Violetta Podramatic, or Telly Mamayak, people I have and have worked with, I think, oh, that's great. I don't even know what that is, but how wonderful. Speaking of immigrants, what is the Cato Institute's or your analysis of the president's proposal, this RAISE Act?
So my proposal, or my analysis, is that it's not going to do anything that its supporters think it will do. It's going to actually lower wages for Americans in the long run. And one of the most disheartening things about it is almost every talking point used to support the bill actually does a lot of the opposite, or the facts are completely different. So, for instance, people are selling this as sort of a merit-based or a skills-based immigration plan. They're saying this will boost skilled immigration to the United States. But when you read the text of the language of the bill itself, it remains unchanged from the current levels, the number of skilled immigrants who are allowed into the United States. All it does is cut family-based immigration and cut other categories like refugees and the diversity visa.
Well, but I think that's in part how they're selling that point. That is, green cards may stay the same, but this lottery that a lot of people are utilizing to get in here, the poorest, the weakest, the wretched, the people that contribute the least to our economy, I mean, unless we get lucky, we can't afford to continue to roll out the welcome mat.
So the point about that, though, is the president said in January that Canada and Australia are going to be the models for the American merit-based immigration system. But both of those countries allow in many, many more skilled immigrants as a percentage of their population, and actually in total numbers under the RAISE Act. But a lot of the supporters are saying that this is a boost to skilled immigration. All it does is change the proportion of the current green cards that are issued by giving them to skilled immigrants. But on the other issue of, you know, lower skilled workers or lower skilled immigrants and their economic contributions. The academic literature on this is fairly uniform in its findings, and that is even lower-skilled immigrants, those with less than a high school degree or with merely a high school degree, contribute more to the U.S. economy than they lower in wages for American workers. And the work on this is cited heavily in the National Academy of Sciences, wrote a huge literature review on this. So it's not that controversial amongst economists.
Well, it is amongst voters. It is amongst people. Folks don't know that. They think, wait a minute, if I had 100 people to let into this country, who would I pick? And if I had my druthers, and you're the United States, you do, I'd want them to speak fluent English. I'd want them to have education so then maybe they won't be criminals. I'd want them to have STEM skills so that we can get the very best of the world. And you can see how people in this country would go, we're the United States. We do get to cherry pick. And that's what this feels like. And I think a lot of people like that idea, Alex.
No, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in terms of criminals and national security threats and healthy people, I think everyone's on the same page with that. But I think that Congress, that bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., that people out here, policymakers, they don't know the types of immigrants that this country needs. The people who know that are out there in the economy every day, are the people who are working, are the people who are employers who actually work with these immigrants.
And what do we need? What kind of employees do we need?
Well, that's for the market to decide exactly. The government cannot tell the number or type of employees or workers that this government, that this economy actually demands any better than the Soviet Union could tell how much steel should be produced in every year.
I understand that point. But here's the way it was pitched to me from somebody who feels quite the opposite of you, that if we let these immigrants in, they're going to compete at the lower end of the economic scale. They're going to suppress the wages then. It's going to, why are people, you know, the economy's doing well. Unemployment is low. And yet, so too are wages. How are we going to boost those up? Well, we've got to stop the tide of people coming in and competing for those jobs. Americans won't do them because they don't pay well enough, but they might if we cut off that lower end of the flow. How do you respond to that?
Well, the first thing is immigrants do increase the supply of workers in the United States, but they also increase the demand for the products made by those workers. And the evidence is pretty clear that immigrants increase the number of jobs that are here in the United States because they consume more than they basically increase in the number of jobs that are here. What we see historically, and economic theory and evidence bears this out, is that more people are good for the economy. People are the foundations of economic growth, whether through consumption or through production, and immigrants make an outsized contribution to economic growth in the United States.
Well, you're having trouble selling that. I mean, you're an economist, and you talk to economists. I'm not, and I'm just telling you, that's a lesson hard learned in America. People don't understand that or even believe it.
I understand that. I mean, economists have been trying to sell a lot of things that we agree on, and the evidence is clear for a very long time, from free trade to immigration to why you shouldn't tax things like capital. But that doesn't change the fact that this bill would result in lower wages, less economic growth, and would ultimately cost the government more than it would save, and that those costs are going to be felt by Americans. I mean, you can look no further than a place like Japan, which has very, very low birth rates, a falling population, an aging population, and basically 27 years of tepid, near zero economic growth as a result of that. So do we want to be an undynamic economy like Japan that isn't growing because it doesn't have any kind of population growth, doesn't have these new ideas, doesn't have this energy? Or do we want to do what the United States has done through much of its history, which is allow people to come here to start businesses, to work, to create, to buy?
But we're letting more people in now than we did in the 70s and 80s and 90s. This number, this is the Jim Acosta point that Stephen Miller argued about. What's the magic number? How many are we supposed to let in? Because we're currently letting in more than we used to. Were we a terrible country when other people were president? Now Donald Trump's there, and he's saying a million's too many. If we cut back to where we were previously, how does that make us such bad guys now?
Well, actually, relative to the early 20th century, there are fewer immigrants just in the total number coming here today than there were, say, from 1900 to about 1915 per year. So the notion that this is returning to normal is not true. And the way that economists, demographers, people who study this measure the number or intensity of the flow of immigrants is as a percentage of the population of the country they're going to. Because, you know, a million immigrants in the year 1900, when there's, you know, 80 million people here, had a lot bigger impact than a million immigrants today when there are 325 million people coming here. So when you take a look at the historical average from 1820 to 1917, the increase in population due to immigration each year is about 0.5%. But today, under our current system, it's 0.3%. It's less. And what the RAISE Act would do is actually lower the immigrant flow in the United States to about what it was during the Great Depression.
Okay, I've got a lot of questions and comments from listeners, and I'd like you to respond to some of them.
Absolutely.
You know, I got to tell you, I don't know how you feel I feel about this. I just want you to know I'm fairly neutral about this, but I can parrot for you what our guest said yesterday, which is different than what you're saying today. So I'll push you that way, Alex, and we'll take some calls from you at 312-981-7200. We're visiting with Alex Noresta. He is with the Cato Institute. He's an immigration policy analyst. We're talking about the president's proposal for a RAISE Act that would limit the number of immigrants coming into this country. So is that good for us or bad? Yesterday, our guest, point by point, said it'll be good for us. He said, for instance, it'll be more demand for low-wage jobs that will increase the wage for those people. And now, suddenly, you will find people vying for jobs that they don't vie for now. I guess you touched on that a moment ago, Alex. If you care to say something about that, I'll let you. Then I'll go on to some calls.
Yeah, I mean, I think a common fallacy that people who support this bill think is that there's a fixed number of jobs. So if we decrease the number of people who are here, more Americans are going to be able to get those jobs.
Supply and demand.
But, yeah, well, they only focus on the supply side. They never say anything about demand. By decreasing the number of people here, it decreases the number of consumers, which means that there's going to be fewer jobs in existence here in the first place. I mean, the supply of jobs is just not fixed over time. We just saw a jobs report today that created hundreds of thousands of new jobs. So in Rory Beck's world, the economy is stationary and we're just dividing up a fixed pie, but that's not how the real world works.
It's an interesting point. This text says, if an immigrant gets a STEM job, as I was describing a moment ago, who doesn't get that job? An American. I see that. I see that point, right? I mean, why are we holding out a good science and engineering job for somebody from an Indonesian when it would be better if it was going to an Illinoisan?
Well, most of the time, these jobs do go to Illinoisans. But the point that sort of I just kind of made actually was that the number of skilled workers who are here in the United States allow firms to expand. So an IT worker, for instance, which is what most of the H-1B visa is. Information technology is one of the things that allows firms to grow bigger, to employ more people. So the evidence says that for about every 100 H-1B workers hired, firms hire about 183 native-born Americans in other roles and other industries, in other sectors and other places in their firms. So it's just, it's different jobs, but it's not the, but the overall effect is positive.
What about this point? Patrick, you're on WGN. What's your thought, Patrick?
Yeah, apparently one of the benefits they're saying is that by doing this, this will raise the minimum wage. But won't that hurt small businesses? And isn't that what Trump is trying to back, is helping small businesses?
What about that, Alex?
So, yeah, it won't raise the minimum wage. It just will have a more positive impact on the wages of lower-skilled Americans and other Americans. And that's because wages are determined by what economists call your marginal productivity or marginal value product. It's just fancy talk for how much you can make in profit for an employer in each hour. And by having more immigrants here in the United States, it increases the productivity of other workers who are here.
Okay,
so
but hold on
like
a second.
Adam Smith 101.
Oh, well, all right, if it doesn't technically raise the minimum wage, employers will have to hire employees at a higher wage. It will increase the minimum amount they can pay employees. Isn't that true?
Yes, but that but those wages go up because these workers are more productive and they make a higher profit for these firms. So that's what determines wages, right? Wages aren't like random in terms of how they're assigned. Their wages are determined based on how much you make for the company. And by having more immigrants, it makes everybody more productive because we can have a better division of labor, and that increases the productivity of American workers, of immigrant workers, of everybody, which means that wages rise because everybody's more productive. And more productivity is, you know, that's what causes economic growth.
Well, if you're so smart, if all of this is true, then how come we're not doing that? Why are we doing this?
Well, thank you for the compliment, by the way. But this is, you know, these are just facts that lots of other people who are far smarter than me have been working on for decades. But, I mean, I could ask that question about lots of areas of public policy. I mean, why don't we cut taxes? Tax cuts lead to more economic growth, but we're not doing that right now. Why don't we have free trade? Free trade is good for Americans, but we don't have that right now. Why do we have an Obamacare law that makes it almost very difficult to hire new workers by putting all these mandates? I mean, we could go down the line. A lot of things are popular that just don't work or are supported by politicians that just don't work. And I'd say immigration is just like all these other issues in that way.
Stay there. We'll talk to Karen next. You're on WGN. Karen, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm just looking at two small pieces to the puzzle here. I'm looking at the social services, and that would be the medical social services and the education in the area of social services. You have lower skilled people come, and you have lower wages. All right, guess what? The supplement that they're going to need.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. What about that? The burden they put on everybody else.
So when you take a look, the National Academy of Sciences just put out a study on the fiscal cost of immigration. And what they found is that if you entered the United States below when you were younger than the age of 24 and you have less than a high school degree, due to the way the laws are and that you can't access means-tested welfare benefits at all for the first 5 years, and then after then it depends on it, those people actually pay more in their lifetime taxes than they consume in benefits. And that's for people with less than a high school degree. Now, those numbers change based on the age they come in and other factors. But the general finding in the academic literature of immigrants' impact on taxes and on budget deficits is that they basically pay their own way over the long run. Now, in terms of their children, which is an important point on the education. In terms of their children who are born here or they bring with them, those children do cost money in the public schools, but you also have to compare that to the lifetime taxes that they pay while they're working here. So it may appear up front, absolutely there is a cost, but my first response to that is, one, you have to compare that to the taxes they pay over the course of their lives, and two, a lot of reforms to the education system, which we should be making anyway, things like school choice and vouchers, would solve a lot of those problems without cutting out these people.
All right, let's go quickly on one last call. All of our lines are busy. I very much appreciate everybody calling. We'll just pick up with Hakan, and then we'll be done. Hakan, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hello, sir. Yes, Mr. Williams. I just want to comment on one thing, say that I'm an immigrant. When I moved to the United States, I had to work in a place that none of the American would work in there because the place that I worked for would pay only $10 an hour, and also was a very heated place, or a plastic company. So I'm not sure how we, if we stop the immigrants. Now, let me just clarify the point before I say that I'm not against what Mr. Trump did or President Trump did or does. So, however, who's going to do those jobs if we stop the immigrants to come in? Who's going to do those slow-paid jobs?
What's your response to that, Alex? Thank you for the call, Hakan.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Nobody will. Those jobs will go away, or they'll be shipped overseas so that people in China or Mexico or other places will do them. I mean, that's just the effect.
If we have more, if I'm confused. If we let these people in, why doesn't the hot plastics job still exist in America?
No, I mean, if we let them in, these jobs do. But if we stop letting them in, then all of a sudden it won't be profitable for a lot of firms to be able to continue that kind of production here.
Okay, that's funny because we're being told the exact opposite, that if we let these people in, that they're going to compete. Well, I guess I don't know that we're being told the exact opposite of that, but you're telling me that if we don't let these people in, it'll be more difficult for those industries to continue to exist here in this country, huh?
That's right. I mean, it depends. The thing is, I'm talking about sort of overall levels.
Yeah, no, I get that. I get that point.
So there are some specific occupations, though, when you absolutely do see wage decreases. So like janitors, for instance, you know, there's a lot of competition, janitors and farm labor and this types of stuff. You do see negative wage impacts from immigration. That's absolutely true. But overall impact is positive by education level. The thing is, some of these specific jobs like this individual caller was talking about, those will go away. And I suspect a lot of them would be in the areas of the jobs that he described of in agriculture or some of these other industries.
Thank you for your time. Listen, Alex, we'll visit again, but we wanted to hear both sides. In the last 2 days we have, I appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks to all of your callers who asked, I think, some wonderful questions.
And I think they did, too, and we would have made we got lots more. We're playing Name That Tune, Steve. Go.
Say that again, John.
We're playing Name That Tune.
Oh.
You're up.
Me and you and a dog named Boo.
How did you know?
Lobo.
We're previewing some of the music at Lollapalooza today. You always seem so sure. By the way, if you see Steve Cochran today, come up to him and he'll give you the name of a band you never heard of. It'll be funny, but boy, he could not help himself today. What are we listening to here, Ella?
This is The Suburbs by Arcade Fire.
Ah, I love... Oh, The Suburbs is a band, but this is Arcade Fire singing The Suburbs.
Yes.
That's way too confusing for me. Do The Suburbs have a song called Arcade Fire? That would be pretty funny.
I don't think so.
All right.
You probably just listen to The Suburbs, right?
In yeah,
the Twin
sure.
Cities?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, they're a local band. I mean, more than that, but near and dear to our hearts up there. And then, you know, Prince and Bob Dylan, that's the whole Minnesota vibe that I come from. So what would be the bands that Chicagoans would say are artists? It would be Chance the Rapper, Kanye West. Mm. Who else are the ones that Chicagoans maybe aren't on that level but hold near and dear to their hearts?
I'd say Mac DeMarco. Oh, sorry, Steve.
No, go ahead.
Mac DeMarco, Catriona, Whitney is one of them. Whitney is from Chicago.
Whitney Houston?
Just Whitney.
Oh, okay.
Whitney. I think it's two guys.
Well, then I'm completely off base.
It's Wit and Knee.
And what about you, Steve?
Well, the earlier would have been Smashing Pumpkins.
Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah. We probably have more bigger names than some of the other cities, too, just because we're bigger.
It's a great suburb song. I can't think of it now, but I used to, when I would come in early Saturdays, I would play the video almost all the time.
Oh, no kidding. That was your little
It was like my morning ritual, yeah.
It is 2:41 on WGN. This is John Williams. By the way, speaking of music at Lollapalooza, we had David just look up what are the tickets going for. If you are planning on going to Lollapalooza, you still can. A lot of folks have already got their tickets, and they are here. But if you want to come downtown, there are tickets online available. There is an official reselling service that they have. It actually kicks you over to, I think it's Ticketmaster. But for today, listed tickets are on resale for $167, $199, $199. The tickets in the 150s have already been gobbled up. If you want to buy single passes for tomorrow online, you pay between $328 and $350. Wow, for one day. Sunday's tickets are available, single passes, $149, $162. A lot of them in the 150s. That's what the secondary market is like for Lollapalooza. And that goes on through Sunday. Then they'll spend all of next week apologizing for what they did to the park. In Naperville, downtown Naperville, it's Make Music Naperville from 1 to 7. Local bands will showcase their music across various stages. That's going on this weekend in Naperville and Rogers Park in Chicago. At Indian Boundary Park, they've got Dance in the Park from 6 o'clock until, I guess, it gets dark, starting at 6 o'clock anyway. They present modern, jazz, contemporary, even tap and ballet works, created and performed by professional dancers from the metro area at a series of parks throughout the city, but you'll see some of that going on in Rogers Park at Indian Boundary this weekend. It's 2:42. A couple of things you might want to think about if you're looking for something fun to do this weekend in Chicago or the suburbs. We do The Bright Side of Life in this last half hour of our show, and if you never heard it, you'll hear it now. If you have, I want you to call 312-981-7200 or text to 312-981-7200 and tell us what something good in your world is, something that is making you smile. It can be something big. Your son's coming home from 2 years overseas. He's been serving in the military and you can't wait to meet him at the airport, or you just found a good hot dog joint you like. I don't know what it is that's making you smile, but tell me what your good news is. Call me now. It's called The Bright Side, 312-981-7200 on WGN. Just got a text from my sister, and I'm not happy about it.
Well, are you going to is it not a bright side issue?
So, you know, Producer Griffin was on with us from the Saturday show.
Yeah.
He can't be on the Saturday show. I asked him to come on today and give us his review of Dunkirk because he's a movie opinion I respect.
Mm-hmm.
He explained to us how the movie's told in three parts with sort of three different timelines. I didn't understand that part of the movie. It was a little confusing to me. He said it could not be more clear. They laid it out perfectly for us. They said 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week. It was really evident what they were doing, at least with that part, even though he acknowledged that the movie is a bit of a puzzle. But that was not the hard part. You understood that when my... You haven't seen the movie yet, have you?
No, no.
So my sister texts me and she says, listen, I hate to say this, but Christopher, that would be my younger nephew, understood the different timelines right away. And he explained them to his little sister, Rachel, after the movie.
Well, that's just a mean note.
So how does that help me?
Right.
It's a person who is in real time trying to do an entertaining and informed radio program for dozens of people. Okay, 312-981-7200 is the telephone number. I also need to tell you the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is dedicated to saving the lives and bringing hope to those affected by suicide. AFSP relies on philanthropic support to help fund research, programs, education, and advocacy to help fight suicide. Join AFSP on Saturday, September 23rd, to raise awareness about mental health conditions and suicide prevention. Walking together will bring these issues out of the darkness and into the light and help everyone look on their bright side. To register or donate, I'm going to be at this walk. I hope you can join us in September. That's on the 23rd. Go to chicagowalk.org, chicagowalk.org. Real quick note about tomorrow's show before we do The Bright Side, and then Anna's going to come in as we get ready for the Rokan show with Anna DeVlantis, and that is that tomorrow we'll talk a little bit more about something I just kind of tripped upon this week, and that was that a lot of you do not have cable and you don't have satellite. You're watching free TV over the airwaves with digital antennas. Hipsters and oldsters are buying digital antennas for like $25. And then you put the antenna on your TV set, and then television comes on, and it's just fine. And you get more than five channels. Somebody said, was it in Northwest Indiana? They get 60, 6-0. I would imagine that's 60 really not good channels. But the people are happy about this. You don't have HBO. You don't have Turner. You don't have ESPN or CNN. You got no Fox News on that. You don't got your Rachel Maddow, whatever the end of the spectrum is. You don't have, you ain't got that.
Just lots of Teletubbies, right?
Right. You get a
think about how much happy you'd be. No Fox, no Rachel Maddow, just the Teletubbies, all the different colors.
You know, maybe you're right, Steve. I should pull the plug. All right, let's do this then. We call it The Bright Side. Elif, my screen has gone haywire. Will you be able to start the Bright Side music for us here? We can't do this bit without the music. Elif has it up. And here we go.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse.
Here we go now.
When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle.
Get ready, here we go.
And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life.
Let's start with the ladies. That'd be Elif, and I think Violetta's in the traffic central, or is Susan in there? Hey, Violetta, you want to do your bright side?
Yeah.
All right, let's hear what your smile is today.
My bright side is that I dressed like a millennial today. I look like a Lala kid.
You do.
And I got my flower headband, and I felt accepted on the streets today.
You do look a little Lala. You also look a little 1968, I'll be honest with you. Either way, the look works for you, so.
Thank you.
Props to your concert gear. Speaking of which, all right, so our music head in the building is Elif Garris. What's your bright side, Elif?
I heard that my dad is visiting soon in September.
Your dad?
My biological dad from Turkey.
Your biological dad does not live with you or is not in Illinois?
No, not even close.
I know you're Turkish. Oh, so your father that I know is not your biological father?
No.
I see. So your real dad's coming from Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Pokey smokes. Will you speak Turkish with him?
We usually speak English, but, I mean, if we're trying to speak privately, then, yeah, we speak in Turkish.
Say, John, I love this segment of your show in Turkish.
I don't know a segment. Ben bu parçayı çok seviyorum, John.
Hey, Steve Bertrand, what's your bright side?
I don't speak Turkish.
I know. It sounded painful.
Several months ago, my wife and my mother conspired for a transfer of old furniture, and it's been weighing on me ever since. Tomorrow, I take care of it.
Not exactly sure what all of that is, Steve.
I'm renting a truck and moving furniture, and then it will be over.
Yeah, we're kind of in the middle of some of that, and my bright side is I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And Steve Bertrand's coming over to my house this weekend to play ping pong, and I can't wait to do that. Steve does not know that, but I'm going to hope that someday. Hey, Susan, this is John. Why are you smiling? You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Smiling because I used to listen to you on the internet when you were in Minnesota, but tomorrow's my 45th wedding anniversary.
Happy anniversary, Susan.
Thank you. And nobody's killed anybody.
Okay. That's right. That's the bar's kind of low, but, you know, you'll take it. Hey, Jill, this is John. What's your bright side?
My daughter got her braces off. Phase one is done.
Oh, man. Always look on the light side of life. Hey, Barb, why are you smiling? You're on WGN.
After 20 years of being in the service, my son is retiring from the Army.
Thank you to him, and thank you for the call. Let's go there to Cindy. You're on WGN. What's your bright side, Cindy?
Hi, John. My husband and I are going to an elephant spa tomorrow, and we're going to wash elephants.
Okay, I don't have a lot of time, but where are you going to wash elephants?
We're going to French Lick, Indiana, to a place called Wilson Ranch. They have three female elephants and a couple of giraffes, and we're going to go wash them and pet them and feed them.
In all the years I've done this, no one's ever called in and said, I'm going to wash elephants. Thank you for the call. This is Arlene. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Hi, John. My daughter and my three grandchildren are coming in tomorrow from Minnesota, and I haven't seen them for 3 months.
Woohoo! Always look on the right side of life. Check this out. You're on WGN. What's your bright side? Hammer.
Driving a beer truck, John. Right side of life.
Are you going to talk to me?
Next week. And
that's to love. Like I used to call my bright side segment for 4 years straight, every Friday in Minnesota. And for 4 years, the only conversation I've ever had with that man is, I'm driving a beer truck. Always look on the bright side of life. I'm so glad you called, Hammer. Hey, Ruth, this is John. You're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Hi, John. I witnessed a miracle on Saturday night. My husband went into full cardiac arrest, and our son did CPR in our neighbor for 20 minutes. So the EMTs got there. He's home today with a defibrillator, and he is a miracle. 90% of people that have that do not survive it. Oh,
unbelievable. Unbelievable. That's better than driving a beer truck. Ruth, thank you for the call.
You're welcome. Always look on the
right side of life. Dave, you're on WGN. What's your bright side?
Well, my friend John, I cannot beat Ruth, but this is Sheriff Dave, and it's bittersweet, but I am taking a position with Charleston, South Carolina Police Department, moving at the end of the month.
Northwest Indiana is going to miss you. All of Chicago is too, Sheriff Dave.
Well, hey, listen, I'll miss you guys too, but hey, that's why God invented the internet. I'll be listening.
By the way, just as you go, I want you to know I was unpacking some boxes and moving stuff into my office, and I found the only bullet that I have ever fired in my life, and that was from the machine gun that was Dillinger's machine gun, right?
Well, once again, John, I got to correct you. No, it wasn't. He stole it. It was ours. It belonged and still does to the Porter County Sheriff's Department.
And it was his. When you guys got it back, you put it on display, and every now and then you let people come in and fire it. Leslie Keiling, our traffic reporter then, and I went out to your place. We took it out to a range with you, and we fired that machine gun. I have a framed bullet from that, and it's just the most unbelievable thing.
Well, you know, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a blast in a lot of ways, and glad I got to know you, my friend.
Safe travels, Sheriff Dave.
Thank you.
By the way, some of the texters include this. Hey, John, I just celebrated 2 years of sobriety. Susan in Chicago, life is good. John, my bright side is I'm going to be a grandpa, says Tim. And Tommy says it's my 36th birthday tomorrow. How about this for a countdown? John, 16 days, 21 hours until what happens in 16 days, 21 hours? Violetta, do you know what's happening in 16 days?
School?
The eclipse.
Oh.
I know. That's not your bright side, is it? It's not exactly mine either. On a line 11, it's Tom. You're on WGN. Why are you smiling, Tom?
Well, 47 years ago, I saw my wife for the first time. 43 years we've been married, and she's still as wonderful as she ever was. So always
look on the bright. Hey, Carrie, you're on WGN. What's your bright side? Or Sherry.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Yep. Hi, John. We're headed down to North Carolina to do some recon for our retirement, and we're going to stay in an Airstream.
Oh, that sounds like fun to me. That really sounds like fun to me. I've never done that.
Yeah, well, I'll let you know how it turns out.
I hope to hear from you, Sherry. Thanks. Carrie, we're going to you. You're on WGN. What's your bright side, Carrie? Hold on, Carrie. Let me put Carrie on there. Hey, Carrie, you're on. What's your bright side?
Hi, my bright side is my husband and his brothers are on a road trip to Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm really happy for them having time together.
And you're also kind of happy they're not hanging around you right now. Is that correct?
That's true.
We do the bright side on Fridays. This time you call in, tell us what your good news is, why you're smiling, and we smile with you. Get your friends to listen to this segment too. I just want to read three other bright sides. John, my bright side is Hammer is back. I love that guy. John, my bright side is it's Friday. I just got cast in a local theater company play. That's not the one I was going to read, but I'm happy for you too. John, I was offered two jobs today after being unemployed for over a year, says Dawn. I'm happy for you too. Rokan and Anna DeVlantis are in the studio. Hi, guys.
That was me, by the way. I did that for him.
Created got jobs.
It. Got it in a job.
Created a job.
Yeah.
Was going to go to Mexico, but now it's here.
Maybe. Who knows? All right. So speaking of that, yeah. Coming up on the program, Susie Sunshine is going to join us from Dallas, as she does every week, to talk about the economy and the markets. And it was big. It's a big, we're having a good moment right here.
You mean in terms of the economy?
Yes.
Dow 22,000 and then a great jobs report as well.
Yeah. So you know, that's Donald Trump's lifeline right now. People don't talk about it in those terms, but imagine if it was going as badly as it's going well, mm-hmm. How much we'd be willing to put up with all the shenanigans we're putting up with.
Right. Oh, there's no question about it. And his economy approval numbers are down, actually.
Really?
I think because of the shenanigans. I think people are like, wait, what's going on here? And it's about tone. If he could fix the tone and survive the Russia thing, he could have a very successful presidency. But I don't see him changing. Let Donald be Donald. That's what they always say.
Speaking of tone, did you guys read the transcripts of his calls to the Prime Minister Turnbull and...
Oh, yes.
And Nieto in Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
I did. And I think it's interesting. I think that's one of the rare things that Trump supporters and Trump haters both read and both feel good about what they just read. The supporters will go, that's my guy. That's him talking truth to power. And the haters go, see, this guy's an idiot. And it's the same 10 pages of transcripts.
I think anybody who thinks he's speaking truth to power, he's whining about his own approval. You know, he's on both of those calls, he's acknowledging either a deficit with Australia about not understanding what that whole thing was that he was talking about. And then with Mexico, he's acknowledging that this was the wall was all political. And he just needs, he's got a political problem here, and he needs that guy to just shut up and we'll work it out. And yeah. They did, actually, because he no longer says Mexico's not going to pay for it publicly.
Yeah, you agreed to never say that. I agreed to never say that.
Right.
But he sure spoke bluntly to him. He goes, listen, we can't have this anymore. We are not going to have this kind of trade deficit with Mexico.
Right, he was that tough-talking, art-of-the-deal-making Trump that you saw in The Apprentice and places like that, and here he was.
And that's great. The problem is that he's also got to be tough with our enemies. So those are our adversaries. Those are our allies, not our adversaries.
That's an interesting point. And then with Turnbull... Turnbull goes, this is not a bad deal for you. It's 1,200 people, and you don't even have to let him in. You just have to honor the agreement. And he goes, yeah, but I don't want to do that. You made a bad deal for us. I can't believe we agreed to that deal, and I don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's the right position for our president to take, but I think people that like him that when the curtain's drawn, he's saying exactly what you'd hoped he would say.
Yes. He's still very good out on the road. You know, you watch what happened in West Virginia yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
There was one guy back there who was so animated. I thought he was going to drop.
Really?
It was like jumping up and down. Yeah. And so I thought, he's turned down by that. That, again, those are very, you don't need to have majorities. You need to have a very activated minority.
What's the election again?
Change.
The election's tomorrow then, right? Is that what that was?
Well, we'll see. We'll
Feels
see what
like
18.
It.
I mean, 18's
like
a big one.
Some days.